Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Well, even though many schools across the region are on break, the learning never stops here on Vox Pop. And to prove it, it's time to reconvene the Science Forum, and we welcome our experts back to the program to continue your education. So give us a call now if you have a science question. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number on this, a call-in show, 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, the scientists are already here entertaining themselves. It's going to be quite a show. Your calls are coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and the experts are here. They are ready to answer your questions and comments, I guess, if you can answer a comment. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us. It's voxpop@wamc.org. Vox, stop mimicking me, Stander. Voxpop@wamc.org. Let's meet our panel of experts.
I am Barbara Brabetz. I am not responsible for Ed Stander's behavior, and I am from SUNY Cobleskill and a biochemist.
Hello, Barbara.
And I'm Ed Stander, also from SUNY Cobleskill, and I actually wasn't mimicking myself. I was mimicking Jim Pickett, who's not here today.
Ah, well, that's right. Where is Jim Pickett? He's not here.
He's gone to warmer climes.
Lucky man.
To experiment on them somehow and report back
so he can write it off.
Yes.
Good for him. Well, once again, the number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. At the top of the show, I mentioned that the scientists are entertaining themselves, and how they were doing that was with the Ig Nobel Awards?
The Ig Nobel Awards. Unlike the Nobel Prize, there's the Ig Nobel Prize, which is a body that gets together, reviews actual submitted research that's been published,
yeah,
and looks for absurdity.
Okay. Oh, this sounds like fun.
Oh, boy.
Favorite from years gone by was a company, they spent $500,000 trying to figure out why people preferred ruffled potato chips rather than flat ones.
And you figured, and you told us why at one point, right?
Yeah, it has to do with the crunch. Apparently, people enjoy hearing the crunch when they're eating it. And if there's no crunch, it's not good.
Okay.
Well, being a biochemist, I thought I'd start with biology.
Yes.
The biology prize went to researchers from five different countries. So it takes a multinational effort to do this.
Ah.
And they demonstrated that wine experts can reliably identify by smell when there is one fly in your wine glass.
Well, that is interesting.
I didn't know a sommelier had to take entomology.
Oh.
Well, they don't have to know what kind of fly, only
just
that it smells.
Well, it's called The Scent of a Fly, and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2017.
Now, I wonder how much money that study cost.
Probably not a lot. I don't think there's a lot of call for that type of research, unless it was privately funded by some fly-laden winery in California who didn't want anyone to know and was getting bad press, perhaps?
I think it was probably a fly-by-night company myself.
Boom.
Now, you know, was this an excuse for scientists just to be able to drink a lot of wine?
Well, the Nobel Prize awards are known for their flair, having to wear tails, long gowns. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance.
Yeah.
And the Ig Nobel awards are more like a circus act. When they're given, they are televised. You can watch YouTube videos of prior awards. In fact, these that were done in 2018 are available. You can look at their web feed.
Well, before we get to the calls, let's hear a couple of more.
Okay. I'm going to read you the article name so you can see how we scientists inflate our own value.
Okay.
And then I'll tell you what it is.
All right.
Okay. The validation of a functional paleocalcial renal model for the evaluation of renal calculi passage while riding a roller coaster.
Mm. In other words, let me try.
Try it, Stander.
It is how to get rid of kidney stones by riding on a roller coaster.
Absolutely. Ding, ding, ding,
brilliant.
Ding, ding.
And what was the result?
It worked swimmingly. I'm trying to find a roller coaster joke there, but I just don't know.
No.
Everybody's hands had to have, they had, yeah, they had those ups and downs. Everybody had their hands in the air, and there was a lot of screaming, and they couldn't tell who were just the passengers and who were the people passing a stone.
Well, that's interesting.
I wonder if they had to pay for the ride.
That's a good question.
It's copay. It's a copay for the ride, right. Not a pay for the ride.
All right, one more and then to the phones.
Oh, my gosh. I think I'm going to go with the Medical Education Prize.
Yeah.
Oh. This was a single author, thank God. A Japanese researcher put out a medical report calling it colonoscopy in the sitting position, lessons learned from self-colonoscopy.
All right, that's it. That's where I draw the line. Now we'll go to the phones. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets are here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. And George in Northern New Jersey, you're first. George.
Thank you. I'm wondering, when we send projectiles or missiles or whatever, to research and photograph objects very far away, like Mars or whatever, how do those fast-traveling objects we send out miss all the debris, for lack of a better term, that's floating around in the universe?
Believe it or not, at least part of that answer is that NASA knows where almost all that floating debris is, and they actually shoot the satellites and ships out to make sure that they don't hit them.
Hmm.
Because the rocket ship has to be going at about 24,000 miles an hour to get out of the Earth's atmosphere. So if it were to hit it, it would be a real mess.
Right.
So it's like a solar game of Frogger. You kind of have to go across the lanes of traffic without hitting anything and coming out the other side. And if you go, that's when you've died.
That's not good.
Nice sound effects.
In other words, there's a map of those objects that are floating around?
Yeah, you can go look at the map. It's online.
Going down to how small?
Yeah, going down to a nut or a bolt.
Wow.
That's been released into space. So the near-Earth objects, the Earth debris, there's a map of it. The map that is online is the one that's right around the Earth's orbit.
Wow, amazing.
Right, but the rest of it is also mapped.
Yes, in the near solar system, not everywhere.
As best as they can, of course, when a satellite, for example, burns up and pieces of it are left, some of the stuff, they don't know exactly what's going on, but they try to stay away from the clouds. That's what they do.
All right, George, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. I remember watching a James Bond movie from the 60s, and there was a satellite in orbit that had alligator-like jaws, and it would snap up other satellites. Could you do that with some of the debris out there, go along with a sweeper, as it were, and just snap it up?
Well, I think the jaw part would work, but the sucking part really wouldn't work. There's really not enough
material in
space.
Well, no, you could just drive right at it and open up the jaws?
Oh, kind of like bulldozer it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
all has to do with the relative speed of the two objects. So 17,800 is about what your typical orbits are around Earth. So you'd have to be going just a little faster than everybody else.
Interesting. All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander here to answer your science questions. Kim in the Hudson Valley. Kim.
Hi. I was wondering how it's possible that there's a flat rainbow in the sky directly above our heads. I have one on camera on video and one on a snapped picture. In other words, if you lay flat on the ground, it's directly above you.
And is it a circle? Does it have a hollow center? What does it look like on the photo?
Just like a regular rainbow would look if you were looking at the horizon.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the one that's a snapshot was actually a double rainbow back to back, as if you had two horseshoes back to back.
Right. A lot of people have reported very similar things, for example, from the top of mountains where you're looking down on them, or from airplanes. Those are called glories. And what's effectively happening, when you see a rainbow like that, what's happening is you're getting light scattered by ice particles in the clouds above you. Even if the clouds are very, very, very thin, it's not rain, it's ice that does it. And you can get, for example, Last night, or just outside of the moon, you could see a rainbow developing around the moon from ice crystals that were in the clouds and the light from the moon coming through it. So it doesn't have to be rain. It could also be ice. And the ice is actually in the clouds that make it.
Yeah, I've also seen two sun dogs within the last month.
Exactly.
Normally,
yeah, it's definitely
we don't
the time
see this low down.
This is a great time of year for sun dogs because our weather allows the skies to be pretty clear but still very cold, and our the effective sunlight that we get is much brighter than it was.
All right, for
December.
Those who don't know, what is a sun dog?
A sun dog is a rainbow-like, well, there's actually several. There's, for example, you can see a, I think just last week I saw it, there was a sun as it's setting and a giant spear going up straight from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's called a sun dog. Also, at about 27 degrees away from the sun
on
both
either
sides,
side. Yep.
On either side, you'll see an area that's colored. And that's also; those are also called sun dogs. And these are all caused by ice crystals in the air,
yeah,
in the upper atmosphere.
Yeah, we didn't normally have those down at this low of a latitude. I've never seen them before in almost 50 years.
Yeah, well, you know, latitude doesn't have much to do with it. It more has to do with where the jet stream is and how many clouds you've got, and how and what the weather's changing. These are usually caused by very high clouds, and sometimes you don't even see them.
All right, Kim, we have to take a break, but thank you for a most interesting call. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is our number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Science Forum today. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz are here. Two emails, and this one comes from Mark. I have a friend who has never owned a microwave. To this day, she still echoes some of the same fears that people used to express back when microwaves first came on the market. Now that it's 2019, is there any proof of danger associated with microwave ovens, or are they now 100% safe? And that is from Mark.
Well, to just josh a little, don't drop those suckers on your foot, because that could really hurt.
Ouch.
But the case of a microwave has a metal frame around it, both in the door and in the walls, all six sides. And that is called a Faraday cage.
Yes.
What that allows the microwaves to do is not penetrate beyond that Faraday cage. The microwaves that are generated by the microwave generator and then sent focused into the middle of the area where you put your food so that your molecules get friction and then warm up, they dissipate as soon as they hit the Faraday cage and are converted to other types of energy like heat.
Mm.
Right. And that's why, for example, even the glass in the front has this black pattern on it.
Yeah.
That black pattern is actually part of the Faraday cage, so nothing can get out through the glass.
Years and years and years ago, GE tried to make a clear window out of Lexan, so out of polycarbonate polymer, and they got it to work fine unless you ran your microwave with no food inside. And then you would melt the door. So that never really made it to market.
Huh. You know, I'd like to see what happens if I were to build a Faraday cage around my house.
We work in a Faraday cage.
Yeah,
Ed
sure.
And I, our building at SUNY Cobleskill was built in 1962. And because it was the height of the atomic age,
yeah,
they were worried about penetration from, was it A-bombs they were worried about?
Electromagnetic pulse?
We actually had a fallout shelter
pulses.
In our basement.
Yeah.
So there was a fallout shelter in our basement that would hold 2,000 people after the apocalypse. There are 55-gallon drums that say civil defense water that we use as our trash cans in the lab, and we won't let them give them up and get different ones. We
right.
love those.
Collector's items,
and
sure.
I paid Ed about 20 years ago now, I paid him $20 to eat a cookie from 1965.
How was it?
It was actually quite
it was
good.
Not it was. Even stale.
So the Faraday cage would work then, and I could protect my home from EMP, and all my electronics would still work?
Oh, sure.
Pretty well, yeah. And if you're trying to teach a class, your students can't get any cell phone coverage, and it's wonderful.
By the way, if there's a post-apocalyptic spot to be, it would be in the basement at SUNY Cobleskill.
Well, if you want to live.
But you wouldn't be able to hear any FM radio.
That's okay, right? I think we've all heard enough of that.
We'll just play our own instruments.
This one's from Dale. If we were able to achieve warp speed like in Star Trek and Star Wars, would our bodies be crushed by the G-forces? That's from Dale.
Well, my guess, I've never had this happen to me, you understand.
Although we work at a Faraday cage, yes, we've never been at warp speed.
But I would say that if you didn't, the trick is acceleration. If you are able to accelerate slow enough, not like, you know, all of a sudden the stars become beams of light. If you're able to accelerate slow enough, your body would be accustomed to that. So
yeah,
there wouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
If you were to go too fast, too suddenly, there's a very good question. But the trick is apparently when you go into warp speed, you're going into hyperspace.
Yeah.
Which means that space itself is changing, but not you.
Okay.
So the basic idea, basic
premise
of that.
So you're bending space to your point.
That's right. The basic premise is that the star is actually moving towards you because you're bending space.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't have much of an effect on you. I'd be willing to try it sometime
okay.
if somebody would develop a warp speed.
Well, that'll be your homework
projector.
For the next show.
I'll talk to Elon Musk.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tom in East Greenbush. Tom, you're on.
Yes, hi, Ray. How are you today?
I am well. And yourself?
I'm fine, thanks. I enjoy your show and hello to the panel. Got a question. We were talking about electric charges a minute ago with the microwave. I had a question, though. It had to do with positive and negative attractions. We all know that magnets positive and negative attract, but why is it that the negative electrons aren't fused to the positive nuclei in an atom? I just must have not paid attention in physics class, but I don't know the answer to that. Do you?
Sure. As best as
I'm
I can.
Hang up and listen. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
And that's because they have mass. It's really hard for two objects that have mass to occupy the same space. And even though there's an attraction between the nuclear forces, we'll call those protons for the most part, and the electrons, which are on the outside, the electrons are much, much less massive than the protons, but they still have mass, and therefore they can't occupy the same space. If you were to pressurize, theoretically, an atom to take its electrons, which are outside the nucleus, and push them into the nucleus, they wouldn't be an electron anymore. They have to change into another subatomic particle.
Huh.
And this is what happens in this inside very large stars, where the electron effectively fuses with the proton because of the amount of pressure, and they become effectively a neutron, which becomes a neutron star.
Ah, all right.
But the pressures are rather large.
I would assume so. Let's go to Peter in Pittsfield. Peter.
Yes, how are you, guys? Can you hear me?
Certainly.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, how are you today? The guests and Ray, how are you?
Everybody's fine, Peter. And yourself, sir?
Thank you.
Good.
But I ate a bad pistachio nut just before, and I can still taste it.
Okay.
But here's my question.
All right.
There's an institute in Zurich called the Zotos Institute.
Yeah.
Where they claim that people can boil hard-boiled eggs just using their minds. I will take my answer.
It's been too long since you've called, sir. All right, boiling eggs with your mind.
That sounds like an Ig Nobel Prize, if there is one.
I think we should put it towards some of these researchers who are part of the Ig Nobel Committee, yeah.
I got to tell you.
I don't know. Sometimes I've given people a glare, but I've never thought that they've really gotten warmer because of it.
And I've met hard-boiled personalities as well.
Oy.
Yeah, that guy, you know, he hasn't called in a couple of months, so it's nice to have a good prank call, you
and
know?
With a bad pistachio.
Prank. That's not a prank.
Oh, he's a great caller. He's
excellent.
A Hall of Famer.
Yeah, and I just don't know. Zotos Institute, I'm sure there's an admission charge.
Let's go to Bill in Scotia. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, I wonder, where does all the tire tread go? Literally, I think billions of pounds of tread are used or disappear each year. And it's not like you see tire dust along the roads or anything like that. And so where does it go?
Okay.
That's a wonderful question. And we've actually had it before. Basically, what happens is it evaporates, or the friction of the road and the tire break down the rubber, and the rubber goes into the atmosphere. They've done studies and found that in the area about 10 to 12 feet from the side of the road on a highway, is filled with the stuff.
Oh.
And as you go further away, it decreases.
Yeah, and there is some particulate that does end up on the side of the road.
Yep.
And in fact, this can lead to some toxicity for birds because they go gritting. They need stones for their crop. We tend to have a lot of stone dust on the sides of our roads as part of our shoulders. They go gritting, and then they grit these pieces of rubber, and it can get toxic. They don't have much of a way to bounce back from that.
And they also have – that was good, bounce
boom,
back.
Boom.
I like that.
Sorry, birds.
They also – it also produces nanoparticles, which are actually the biggest problem because they can actually go through the alveoli in your lungs and go into your bloodstream.
Ah.
So it's not the best place to live.
All right.
There's a researcher at New York State Department of Health who looks for environmental contaminants in Arctic and Antarctic species. So they look at penguins and polar bears and seals, ones where there are limited access to civilization.
Yeah.
And they look for transport of these environmental pollutants, and they find things like the rubber dust in the bloodstreams and livers of these animals.
Okay.
So there's a global transport.
Well, Bill, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. And Steve at Delmar. Steve, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Ray. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
But let me go right to my question. I'd like to revisit the space debris issue and ask, why can't they put up a big magnet up there and draw the smaller particles away, assuming they're a nuisance?
They could. They could. I think it really comes down to money.
And
the reason why we don't go and grab, like with Ray's alligator idea, is that you could do it with some good programming and just avoid it.
A lot of it as well is magnesium alloys. Most of it is not magnetic.
Ah, very interesting.
Yeah, the most of the stuff, titanium, magnesium alloys, things like that, are not magnetic, so it would be very, very hard to get it that way.
Plus, there's that Elon Musk convertible with the with the astronaut in it.
Yeah.
I think somebody would go up to get that. Well, probably worth a lot in the secondary market.
You want to follow up, Steve?
Can I ask? Yes, I'd like to follow up with do those particles or pieces or masses, will their orbit decay and fall into space's atmosphere?
All the time.
Or Earth's atmosphere, excuse me.
Yes, they fall in all the time. In fact, we get just between those particles and pieces of meteorite, for example, we get about 11,000 tons per day coming into the atmosphere.
That's amazing. 11,000 tons.
Yeah. Most of it burns up, of course, but that's what happens.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. The number here is 800-348-2551. George in Swanton, Vermont. George.
Yeah, hi. A couple of years ago, my son and I were coming up through the Adirondacks, and there were there was a cloud formation that looked like consecutively small to large diameter, stacked right on top of one another, perfectly round and square on the edges. And it was basically a clear evening. So I was wondering what caused that.
Square edges stacked on top of each other, so kind of like a layer cake?
Correct.
And it was dark? Were the clouds dark or light?
The clouds were white.
Mm-hmm. They were white.
I've seen that. And most of the time, and I can't say in this particular situation, and I'm sure there's a meteorologist out there that'll be screaming into their phones right now. Basically, you're in an area with a lot of mountains. And mountains are going to bring the air, particular air, especially inversions, higher and lower. And so what happens is some of this cold, wet air that's towards the bottom, as it goes by the side of a mountain, it rises up. And as it rises up, it cools off more and it expands. Mm. And that produces exactly what you're seeing.
These are lenticular clouds?
They're not really lenticular. They're almost they're almost like wedding cake clouds.
Oh, okay.
And it requires you to have a particular type of cold, wet air at the bottom coming up to the top of the mountains to make them form.
And it would mean, theoretically, that they would always form in the same locations because the terrain below is really contributing to their formation.
It depends on how much humidity there is in the atmosphere and also the temperature variation from top to bottom.
Sure.
But again, I'm sure there's a meteorologist who will come sooner or later and tell
and
me
complain.
That I'm totally wrong.
You're right.
We've got 28 minutes. Yep.
George, thanks for the call. We go now to Becky in Delmar. Becky, you're on.
Hey, neighbor. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you?
Good. I have a question about the Northern Lights. A couple of years ago, Ben and I made a trip to Iceland to see the Northern Lights. we were very lucky and saw a spectacular display. The display to the naked eye was, there was white that was just barely pale green, very, very pale, and like a very pale jade, and then there were the pinks and stuff. But his photographs, the green was extremely intensified in the photographs that he took.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
What causes that phenomena?
It's called long-time exposure. When you're looking at it with your eye, you're getting an instantaneous image of what's there. But if you take an exposure with your camera, you're getting a much longer period of time. You're getting a time exposure, effectively, in order to get these things. And so the
The green's piling up on top of itself.
Yes, exactly. You wind up getting a much brighter image because it's collecting.
And if you use a cheap device like a cell phone, although that's not very cheap, but it's pretty sophisticated.
No, he had really good equipment.
Okay. But nowadays with these cell phones, they have settings for twilight, sunset, or sunrise, and they'll automatically enhance the color to show the differential, because sometimes what we see is sunrise or sunset, for example, where, you know, we've all seen those. Not all of us have seen the northern lights. You take a photo and the photo just doesn't do it justice, and people get upset with their personal devices because they don't quite do it. So they've made these settings that will automatically vary the exposures in those areas of intensity.
You know, I thought there was something component of this, something to do with the rods and cones in our eyes and vision at night.
That's very true, too. I was going to say that, too. Yep. But our perception of what we can see at night is more about movement and less about intensity.
And cameras have very good CCDs in them, closed-coupled devices, which are much more sensitive to certain colors, especially green, so they bring out the greens as well.
Well, Becky, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz are here to answer your questions. We go to our buddy Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim.
Hi, Ray. Hi, scientists. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I have the great pleasure of having observed a double sun dog.
Mm-hmm.
I was out next to my house. There was a very thin cirrus layer, and the sun was at about 30 degrees off the horizon, and there was a sun dog to the left of it and a sun dog to the right of it. And I don't know if anybody else has ever seen anything like that, but I did.
Wow.
I've been lucky. I really like sun dogs. They're one of my favorite things, and I probably bug Ed more than I need to. Every time I find one, I take a photo, call him up, and say, sun dogs. But on the way to work this time of year, because of my time of going to work doesn't vary, but when the sun comes up varies during the year, I get to see more sun dogs, and including these doubles. The doublets are really quite awesome because you get, and it's double the fun. Plus, you get a lot of color this time of year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And coming
it was absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, I've seen double glories for the same reason. If you're in an airplane and you're seeing the shadow of the airplane in the cloud, you'll very often see double glories. And when you do see those, the colors of the rainbow are reversed in the outside one.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So if you look at that, it's really quite cool.
Well, Jim, thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks for being there.
Have a good one. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Well, let's grab another call or two before our next break. Bill in Rensselaerville. Bill.
Yes, good afternoon, sir. My question is about the ozone hole. Haven't heard much about it lately, but the fact that the Earth spins on its axis, does that have anything to do with the opening, with the formation of a hole? Just the way, if you took a container of water and spun it real fast, the centrifugal force would appear, you know, to create a hole in the center. The liquid would flow out to the ends, to the edges. Could that have anything to do with the ozone hole?
Yes, it's part of the whole recipe that gets us our ozone layer. The other component is that ozone is depleted as part of the natural course of things and of the unnatural course of things. And it's also replenished, but it takes a while for where it's replenished to actually, it's replenished down here, and then it has to migrate up quite a distance. And so there are times where the replenishment is slower than the use, and so we get a thinning, and that's when the holes open up. So this time of year, actually about a month ago, is when it's the thinnest. And it's at both poles, but, you know, it's kind of cold at the Arctic So we don't really get naked a lot at the North Pole in February or January, unless someone pays us a lot of money. The problems in certain parts of Australia, for example, where there's a continent near the South Pole, they have significant ozone hole warnings where the UV penetration of our atmosphere is significant. Being that there's a fair skin population in Australia, they have a very high incidence of all of the skin cancers because of that. It's their summer, and it's the same time that the ozone hole is thin.
All right, Bill, thanks for the call. Ed Stander's here. Barbara Brabets is here. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Yes, it's the Science Forum, and I'm still thinking about the guy who can boil eggs with his mind. Maybe we'll touch on that subject again sometime, or maybe not. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ed Stander's here, Barbara Brabets here, and you are there at 800-348-2551.
You know, Ray, we should do a podcast someday of all the stuff we do in the breaks.
You know,
it's not necessarily good for broadcast, but it would be good for podcasts.
We talk about that on the roundtable panel, too.
Some of that's
very interesting during the break.
Jim Pickett is here as well, but he's not speaking.
Very wise choice, Jim. David in Chatham. David, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Comment or a question about a prior caller regarding the electrons, what keeps them from falling into the protons, I think was the way it was phrased. Is that the strong force or the weak force? Is it one of those two?
Well, there's both strong and weak forces. There's an attractive force and a repulsive forces, and both the strong and weak forces are present in these subatomic particles. So it's a combination of both. And obviously the strong force by name has a larger effect and the weak force has less. I mean, we haven't quite gotten that down in science to give it snazzier names than that. But then at the same time, then somebody named the quarks. So, and they got really weird with the names of quarks.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Gluons and all of that.
Yeah, the gluons, the bosons.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, David. And now it's time for Ian in Saugerties. Ian.
Hi, how are you?
Oh,
thank you for taking my call.
Okay, you're welcome.
So I had one less relevant inquiry, which is, you know, I wonder how much organic matter is produced by solar energy coming onto the planet over the millions of years being converted into whatever, you know, foliage or, you know, plants and animals using that. The other thing would be, and that might not be relevant to the conversation, but the other thing would be, can't we take all the garbage in the five gyres of the ocean and kind of dump it where the oceanic crust is diving down under the continental crust and let the earth just suck it in and turn it into magma and recycle it? The other thing I was wondering is, what would you guys say about that? I have heard about the entire solar system heating up, the sun being hotter, Pluto having polar ice caps that are melting, and along with Mars having Pluto ice caps that are melting.
When?
I know that we're also getting hotter and our pollution and carbon dioxide emission doesn't help, but there's also this thing with carbon taxes in the EU, and it seems like a way that the banks are kind of hedge funding these.
Right. Let's try to focus a little bit here and start with one question. And the first question was what?
It was the accumulation of organic molecules from the action of the sun.
Okay, let's do that one first.
So, Ian, the sun is our energy source. It's our bank. But the matter that's on this planet is relatively finite. Yes, Ed has talked about the amount that we get from outer space every year.
Yes.
And there's poundage of water that comes in every year from comets that buzz by.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't start with as much water as we now have. We've accumulated more over time. And when you say 4.8 billion years, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's a reasonable amount
of time. You know, the clutter kind of catches up to you. But for the most part, the carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen, the nitrogen that makes up organic molecules was already here.
Yeah.
It's the energy to put them together that we've harvested from the sun.
And so it's producing plants. The plants die, and if you're lucky, they decay. And if they don't, they form coal or oil, and that's or ice clathrates, for that matter. And then that is the storage mechanism.
Okay, mechanism. And then very quickly, and we only give one question per customer, how about this plan to take the garbage and sink it?
Well, I think it would be more relevant the latter one, with the whole solar system heating up.
Okay, the whole solar system heating up.
Well, what's your time scale? Because at the moment, we're at a solar minimum. Our sun, Ed, you want to talk about the cycle?
Well, I can tell you this. This might be the best way to say it, is that underneath the sun's surface, there are currents. And sometimes those currents are additive and sometimes they're subtractive. And we know that because the currents underneath the sun actually are what produce sunspots, for example. So there are sunspot cycles. And sometimes these cycles are very long. And studies have been made now to suggest that from about 2030 to about 2050, we're going to be in a colder phase simply because of the way these cycles work. So the sun does get hotter. The sun gets colder. I can tell you that the ice caps on Pluto aren't melting because it doesn't get enough sun anything.
The sun looks almost like another star at Pluto.
Right. Let's go.
So, yes, it does make a difference, but not that much.
Well, Bob Berman has told me before that the sun is actually every X number of millions or billions of years, the sun gets 10% more luminous.
That's correct.
Right. And so at some point, it will get, before it turns to a red giant, it will get more luminous. And it'll be too hot to live here. Maybe at that point, the solar, the polar ice caps melt on, various planets.
Right. Yes. And Mars lost its ice cap, a lot of its water a long time ago.
Right.
Billions of years ago.
Eric in Niskayuna. Hello, Eric in Niskayuna.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a question about the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, and the shape of the universe. I understand that there was a singularity and everything expanded out and the galaxies expanding from that. But what I've read is that there's no edge of the universe, and the universe is isotropic, meaning that there's no center. So how can it be that there's a singularity and they described it as like a rubber balloon or you put dots on it, and then as the whole space is also expanding. So what is your opinion on what the shape of the universe is, and how can there be no edge if there was a singularity?
Well, we're actually within the singularity, if you can imagine, because it's been expanding and we're within this balloon that's been expanding ever since. The trick is this. It started at a point and then it expanded outwards. And as it expands outwards, the temperature of the universe changes. It actually decreases. So, for example, at the beginning, it was extremely hot, and all the energy that was being produced was probably gamma rays or such as that. And as it's expanded, the energy has decreased so that at this point, because of redshift, we're now into what are called microwaves. Okay? And every direction that we look from where we are, because we're within that, effectively within the same singularity, every direction we look, space is the same. That's the isotropic part of it. And what it suggests is that it's expanded equally in all directions. So if you want to describe what the universe is like, basically it's like being inside of a giant balloon in which it's expanding in all directions equally.
All right. You want to add anything to that, Barbara?
Just the cool thing that if you're old enough to remember broadcast televisions and you would turn to a channel that didn't have a broadcast, you'd get that background.
It's got it.
Yeah.
That's the Big Bang.
That's the microwave background?
That's the microwave background of the Big Bang. Well, and some X-rays, too.
All right. Let's go to Rachel in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rachel.
Hello. I have a question about, an issue that a lot of people are confused about, and I have been confused. Right after conception, assuming the necessary environment and nutrition is provided, does a human zygote have the ability within itself to develop into a mature human being, or does the mother or some other thing have to come into it to turn it into a human, so to speak?
Well, I don't know what turn it into a human means, but
what is the science?
If you have an ovum, which is an incomplete unfertilized egg that then is penetrated by a sperm, and you have a fusion of the genetic material of the two, there's an extra step that has to happen, and that is that that new zygote has to implant on the side of the uterus in order for it to get nutrition and also to trigger a bunch of changes hormonally, chemically, to say, okay, the job is done. I've landed the plane. It's time to grow. If you don't, if you have fertilization without implantation, then there's no pregnancy.
Okay, so it has to attach to the womb.
Yes, correct. It does. And the womb, okay. Not only does the womb need to be there, but the womb has to have certain chemical signals to say, yep, I'm ready to do this.
Okay.
So everything needs to be open.
Well, Rachel, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Barbara Rabbits and Ed Stander are here. Bob in Broad Auburn. Bob.
Thank you. My question may be a bit complex, but at the end I'm focusing on dark matter and the universe as it ages. Einstein taught us that by the equation, simply the mass-energy relationship. And now as the universe ages, progressively more energy gets locked up in mass. And we are aware of all of the celestial bodies that occur in various types, going to black holes and then a singularity. Now, my question focuses on dark matter being antiquarian, that is, that all dark matter came into existence at the beginning of the universe. The question to me is, considering what happens with ordinary matter, standard model of fermion matter, that as the universe ages, more and more energy gets locked up into that kind of matter, thanks to Onlayer and Peter Hicks, we understand what happened. With dark matter, and understanding also that dark energy is a repulsive force with respect to a gravitation field or a complex gradient in space. As dark matter, as the universe ages, I believe that dark matter diminishes. And if that's true and you understand that, what happens to that material that disappears that was once dark matter?
Okay.
What transformation occurs?
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, we don't know what dark matter is. So to be able to say what actually happens with dark matter is very difficult. Second of all, there are a lot of scientists today who are beginning to realize that dark matter may not actually exist. But what's happening is that we're looking at processes that are much larger that can be handled with Einsteinian physics. And third of all, if dark matter does exist and is being created, for example, by neutrinos, neutrinos are being produced all the time. Whenever a sun, for example, blows up, neutrinos are being produced. It's really hard to say what happens to dark matter over time because, well, we don't know even know how much there is there. So it's sort of an open question on all levels at the moment.
Okay. Carol in Spencertown is next. Carol.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I wanted to comment. You opened this session today talking about the sommelier study who could detect a fly in the wine.
Yes.
And I want to validate that.
Excellent.
I'm not a sommelier, but I bet the study was about fruit flies.
Okay.
And if you handed me two glasses of wine and one had a fruit fly in it and one didn't and I was blindfolded, I could smell it and I could taste the one with the fruit fly every single time.
Wow. And you know, the funny thing about the Ig Nobel Awards is not that they're fake. They're not. It's real research that's done that people think is absurd, that it has that flair of absurdity to it.
Right.
For example, the research I do in the summertime has to do with looking at water quality on the Mohawk River here in upstate New York. We're going to start looking at DNA to be able to track where the water quality is poor. Is it because of human intervention? Is it agricultural? Is it wildlife?
Yeah.
So we're doing DNA studies. We need to come up with a control for DNA that we do not think is going to be in the river, and we came up with kangaroo. because we need to make sure that if the kangaroo is positive in the river, then we know that there's something wrong with our methods.
Yeah.
If I publish that, people will write that Brabitz is looking for kangaroos in the Mohawk, and I'm not. But there's a reason why.
Good headline.
Yes.
I have a totally different question for you, and I'm just wondering, how can you tell if there's a fly in it if it's a fruity wine?
Because it's a fruit fly.
Carol, right. have you done this?
That's a joke. There's a punchline on there somewhere.
Yeah. Usually there is with Ed.
Flies are drawn to wine. I have a fruit fly trap, a homemade one that you just put a little dish on the counter and
sure.
put some red wine in it and a drop of dish detergent. And if you have a big fruit fly problem the next day, you're going to find it full of dead fruit flies.
Yeah.
Well, and isn't there...
It's like they were drawn to vinegar.
There's a phenotype for a fruit fly that you can buy in the fruit fly catalog. The Drosophila catalog,
yeah.
And it's called Cheap Drunk. And they have a gene in them that makes them alcoholic, that they will do things for wine that normally they would be shamed otherwise.
Well, Carol, thanks so much for that call. And now we go to John, who's on the road near Amherst. John, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll ask a quick question and then hang up.
Okie doke.
Could you ask your guest, please explain what a green flash sunset is?
Green flash sunset. I think you mentioned that, Ed.
Yes, that's pretty simple. What happens is as the sun sets, it actually winds up being below the horizon, but you can still see it because of refraction of the lower atmosphere, usually because the lower atmosphere is a bit hotter than the stuff above, so you're seeing a mirage. And as the sun sets far enough, you go from red to suddenly get some green, and the green is caused by the fact that the light is being refracted towards your eyes a little bit more than it would be otherwise.
Right, and it has to be a flat sunset, otherwise you won't see that green flash.
All right. Lou in Altamont. Lou, you're next.
Yes, I was watching a program on volcanoes yesterday, and they had a gentleman climbing down into the volcano to do temperature sensing and gas sensing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one of the problems, obviously, is that the ground can be very unstable, but the magnetism of the magma pool down below, I thought at that temperature magnetism would not be there, not be present.
Well, you
so I don't know if he meant mental magnetism of watching something down there swirling and
there's
like fire.
There's two possibilities here. One is that he didn't say magnetism, but he said magmatism.
Magmatism,
which is the movement
that would attract somebody.
Excuse me.
Or, he said, I can risk falling because of rock wave shifting or the magnetism.
Well, magmatism would be the movement of
what
the.
You just said yes.
Yes, would be the movement of the lava underneath him. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that if you're on a hard surface, and if you're on a lava surface, as the lava cools, it does develop a magnetic signal. So it's not the magma underneath that has the magnetism, but the surface. Now, there's no reason why that should have affected him. I think the magmatism is probably what he was talking about.
All right, Lou, thank you very much. And very quickly, we only have about 25 seconds. Julie in New Paltz. Julie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask you, I was reading an article about cleaning up the plastic in the ocean.
Yeah.
And they keep sending out all this equipment and making new contraptions, and they send it out and it falls apart, and they send it out and it falls apart.
Yeah.
And they can't seem to clean up the ocean. So my question is, what's going on with the ocean currents or whatever that we're not cleaning up that plastic that's in the ocean?
Okay.
Well, it's pretty much more like, why are there 7 billion people who are throwing their stuff away? More than it is about the ocean. This is just an issue of scale.
Okay.
There's a lot of people and a lot of stuff, and that stuff has to go somewhere. And if we don't reduce, reuse, recycle, it'll very well end up in the ocean.
Amen.
Barbara Brabitz and Ed Stander, thank you for being here. We are just about out of time. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Paul Smith's College, the College of the Adirondacks, where your campus is a 14,000-acre lakeside wilderness offering career-based education since 1946. paulsmiths.edu. And Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. grapesandgrainswine.com. Thanks again to Barbara Brabitz and Ed Stander for being here. Thank you for listening for some very good calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Dina Salzman took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we will take a culinary trip across the pond as the folks from Old English Pub with an E, Oldie English Pub in Albany, bring us food from food and drink from the land of the Union Jack. Oh, this is good. So what? Boiled meat and some
boiled eggs,
some potatoes. It'll be very exciting. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.